You don't want to pull up and find the officer dead in the house.
No, it's and true.
Hydrogen sulfide, for example. I always tell everybody that doesn't know about it, it quickly makes you nose blind, depending on what level it's at, because when you'll get a first smell, and then at a certain level, it's around 500 ppm, you actually can't smell it anymore, so you think it went away. But over that level is when it starts to get deadly. So if an officer to walk in doesn't have that training, gets a hit of it, and says, oh, it went away, and starts walking to the house, you could easily find them dead in the house. Maybe it's even something that they need to add into the training program for new recruits.
Yeah, a couple hours at the police academy just to go over that would be sufficient. All right, welcome to another episode of 1075 Chatter. Today I have Brian Dable with me. Brian's a current fire chief, former fire chief, former officer in all aspects in Mine Hill. And he's also very up to date on his OSHA standards. And I'm going to let him introduce himself and give a little bit about his background. And welcome.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. So, yeah, like you said, I've been with Mine Hill for 15 years now. Started off when I was 16 as a junior, went all the way through to chief. Currently doing my fifth term as chief. We do one-year terms in Mine Hill. And aside from that, I'm a manager of safety for a company called Carry Out Foods. So we have a whole bunch of divisions where we do different manufacturing, plastics, papers, food products. So I do safety compliance there. And then I also have a company called BGD Safety and Compliance doing safety consulting and training for both general industry and fire departments.
So a pretty good resume there. Big safety guy. And, you know, I've seen Brian on other platforms and followed him a little bit, and he's got some interesting stuff. He does some interesting topics that I really wanted to discuss with him today. Oops. And, you know, Brian, I guess I'll kick it off with a couple things that are on my mind, because I know we were just shooting the breeze a few minutes ago, but hearing loss was one that I saw, and we were just kind of talking about it, because I do have some hearing loss, and it's probably fire service related, and I do have some tinnitus, so... And I know you had talked about that. So if you can give us a little bit about what your findings are on that, that'd be great.
Sure. So one of the things I do a lot with in the safety field is respiratory protection, which is huge in the fire service because of what we do. And when you're looking at different things that you're using respiratory protection for, you're looking at the hazards that are associated with those substances you're exposed to. So one of the things I'd come across was autotoxic chemicals. It's about a year ago. It was new to me, something I hadn't seen yet. So I started looking into it. I said, okay, you know, I understand the concept, a chemical that can get absorbed through your skin where you can inhale it, and it's going to naturally target your auditory nerve, and it's going to affect your hearing. So I said, I'm curious what substances these are. So I started looking into what autotoxic chemicals exist, and the first ones that came up were carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, all the ones that are prevalent in smoke or, you know, when we deal with carbon monoxide incidents in the fire service all the time. So these are the same chemicals that are essentially causing cancer. They're also causing hearing loss. Started doing some research, and I came out with that article that went in Fire Engineering. And then, like you said, you saw the podcast that I did with Fire Engineering on that. So essentially, you know, these chemicals we're exposed to, as you're exposed over time, they target your auditory nerve, and they start to break it down. And in conjunction with high noise exposure, it actually makes it easier for high noise levels to damage your hearing when it's also exposed to those chemicals because they're weakened.
Okay, I got you. Because, I mean, years ago, I mean, I've been in the fire service for 33 years now. And, you know, it was always, oh, you drove with the window open with the siren going. There was no other explanation other than just, you know, loud noises. But now you're saying, you know, it's a toxic thing too, you know. Mostly from off-gassing and, I guess, from smoke and carbon monoxide.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you have a carbon monoxide incident, obviously that's an easy way to be exposed. Overhaul without respiratory protection is a huge cause of it. Now with all the plastics and the furniture and all the furnishings, these chemicals are even more prevalent and causing a bigger issue for us. And like you said, I have some of the same issues. I've been doing it 15 years now. You know, I'm pretty young, and I'm seeing some of the issues.
Yeah, so you're getting some of the ill effects already.
When you say hearing loss, it's not that you can't hear. It's background noise makes it very difficult to hear a conversation you're having.
Yeah, and that's my biggest issue. If I'm out at a restaurant, noisy environment, it's very difficult to hear. And it's kind of almost, you know, you get to a lip reading or, you know, you have to, what? It's tough. My wife thinks I just selectively turn her off, you know, and don't listen. But I truly do.
I have the same issue.
So it's a, you know, it is a real thing, but, you know, it was something interesting because I had never heard about it, and I happened to be watching one of the podcasts, and I was like, wow, this is really great information because it does help explain, too, some of the issues that I'm having that you talk about and that I'm sure, you know, a lot of firefighters are like, well, they told me it was because I, you know, it's sirens and air horns. Well, it is sirens and air horns, but as you're saying,
yep,
it's brought on by other things that doesn't help it, right?
Well, and the easiest thing to deal with it is it's the same stuff that they're talking about doing for cancer prevention. So the respiratory protection, so you're not inhaling, but also now a big thing that's also coming out with these new OSHA standard is gross decon. So getting it off of your skin, getting it off of your gear, keeping your gear clean, clean cab concepts, so that you're not absorbing those chemicals through your skin. There's actually a lot of studies now, which is pretty alarming, showing that the children of firefighters have a substantially higher risk of developing childhood cancer because of the parent being exposed as a firefighter. So we're passing it genetically to children. Or, you know, also you've come home with stuff and put it in the washing machine and, you know, it gets on their clothes.
All the stuff they say not to do, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, we go through it and, you know, I know we had a conversation before and, I mean, in our firehouse, we don't have showers, we don't have locker rooms and it's, you know, it's something that really, you know, every firehouse should have nowadays so that you can try and leave as much of it behind.
We don't have it either. You know, we got to go home.
Yeah. It's, you bring it home in your car, you know, do you decon your car? Well, you're in a different situation. You have a vehicle from the fire service, but, you know, guys drive home in their cars and then their kids are in the cars or, you know, you may have your kid in your fire vehicle, depending if you're going somewhere in town or something, you know, you never know. And, you know, now you're exposing everybody to the same thing. So, I mean, you know, we learn more and more every day. And you know, I was watching, I think I saw you talk about wet decon coming out of structure fires and how it would reduce, I think it was 80% was the number that you said.
Correct. So they have two options. You do wet or dry decon. So, you know, areas in the Northeast, like where we are, if you get a day that's, you know, 10 degrees and you have a structure fire, you don't want to be hosing everybody down. They're going to be an ice sheet. So dry decon, just scrubbing, standing in front of a PPE or a PPV fan to get that stuff blown off of them, shows to be about 30% effective, roughly. And then when you start to do the wet decon, where you spray them down, scrub them, spray again, and then shower within the hour type concept after that, it shows to be 80% effective.
That's a big number. I mean, the effectiveness wise, I mean, it really, really does help. I mean, I know, you know, they give the, you know, a lot of departments have the body wipes for, you know, when you get back and just to try and help out. But I mean, it is a huge issue in the fire service. Cancers of all kinds. And, you know, I understand the whole, you know, I've lost both my parents to cancer. My wife's had a cancer survivor. So, you know, I've been lucky so far, you know, to be clean, but, you know, I've been in the fire service 33 years, so you never know. And we're in a part of New Jersey where cancer rates are higher than the average in the nation, right?
A lot of it has to do with the radon in the ground, too. So I know, like, where I'm from, Mine Hill, we have high radon levels, which contributes to that increased risk of cancer. So think about if you're exposed to these chemicals and fire all the time, and then you're also exposed to that radon, you know, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, we have high radon. I actually have radon mitigation in my house because of it. I mean, it's common here because it's the bedrock and the limestone. I think they say limestone is the biggest culprit of it.
It's able to easily get to the surface.
So yeah, great, right? We're sitting in the trifecta up here.
Yep.
But yeah, no, it was you know, it was refreshing to see some of the stuff coming out that you're really working on, and you know, to be in fire engineering and, you know, to be a young chief, and you know, I think you said you were chief when you were 22 years old.
Yeah, started originally. When I was 22.
So, you know, even though you're a young guy, you still got a lot of experience, and you know, you can see by the amount of research and stuff that you do that you're very into the fire service and safety and stuff like that, which appreciate. You know, it's good to see that you know, you got the young guys that want to really step it up and, you know, understand the fire service and try and make a difference. I mean, that's what we need at this point. You know, and I know you're kind of, I read some of the stuff that's going on with the OSHA changes that are going to affect NFPA, or was that 2025 they were talking about? It was the original what they were talking about?
Correct.
And I was reading it and I got confused, but I watched another podcast that you discussed a lot of it, and it was pretty interesting stuff that you were talking about. So, I don't, you know, if you want to go into a little bit of that here.
Yeah, sure. So I guess just quick summary. They put this proposal out the beginning of 2024. It's a notice of proposed rulemaking is what OSHA refers to it as. It was about 600 and some odd pages of text. But what you don't realize is a lot of that is the background as to why they're doing this, their studies. So you gotta weed out the stuff you don't really need to look at the actual proposed regulatory text. So because everybody was panicking and it was hard for people to understand, you know, I do this all day long for a living, I took it, broke it down. I made a PowerPoint. It's about 190 slides. Starts off with the stuff that we currently have to be doing and then the proposed what's to come and how that's going to change and what it's going to require. So I've been offering that class through my company, BGD Safety. I've done it about 8 times now. I have another one coming up tomorrow. I'll be up in Beamerville for the Sussex County Chiefs Association. Okay. So it's all the Sussex County Chiefs. And essentially, what they're looking to do is take the existing fire brigade standard in OSHA, which is 1910.156. And it was written in the 70s with the intent of regulating private fire brigades, such as in like a petroleum facility.
We had one in Frank Lakes in the Beckton Dickinson facility.
Yeah, about exactly.
10 guys. It was big, you know, big industrial or manufacturing always had a fire brigade of some sort.
So they wrote the regulations back then, and if you actually look at the text now and you follow it, you'd still be in knee-high boots. So it's very outdated. Nobody follows it. So they're going to completely eliminate that text and change it to what they're calling an emergency response standard. It essentially has two facets. One is still those private fire brigades. And then on the other end is what they call emergency service organizations. So it's their way of saying this is what fire departments, first aid squads, and technical rescue squads have to comply with. Law enforcement's exempt unless they engage in some sort of technical rescue. So if you get like an ESU unit, when they're doing those activities, they would be applicable to those regulations. When they're doing SWAT or they're doing normal patrol activities, they're exempt. And it goes through, there's a ton of stuff, everything starting from a community risk assessment for you to really actually assess what risks are in your community, what you guys are going to set as your standard level of service. Goes into an emergency response plan, a risk mitigation plan. You have to have all these documented, all the SOPs you have to have, specific topics that they're looking for SOPs on, your vehicles, maintenance-wise, operating-wise. There's a huge amount of training in there. Just a couple of quick things to call out with the training. New Jersey, what I'm finding is pretty far ahead on training compared to other states around us.
Okay.
So a lot of people in New York have to bring their training up to speed because their Fire One is not quite what our Fire One is.
I can't say anything because my Fire One was not quite what everybody's taking now.
Yeah.
It's a little different than what...
Well, the Fire One program now in New Jersey is drastically increased in hours. They put a lot of rapid intervention into it, safety and survival techniques. But so they're going to require that everybody who is an interior firefighter be trained to the operations level of what's currently NFP 1407, which is rapid intervention. So if you don't have a RIC team, you don't do RIC team training, you're going to be required to do that at least to the operations level. So if you look in that NFPA standard, it outlines the different skills you have to have. On top of that, fire officers are going to have to comply with NFPA 1021, I believe is the number, which is fire officer level 1. So I know that was a big thing. People have been taking it, but it's not quite mandatory yet. That's coming.
Doesn't that have a requirement to be a fire instructor, though, as well?
Yes. So to be a fire officer, to get fire officer level 1, you have to, for a prerequisite, have firefighter 1, firefighter 2, fire instructor. You have to have, to get fire officer in the state of New Jersey, they also require strategy and tactics, incident safety officer, and building construction, which are all around 16 hours apiece. So there's a lot of prerequisites to even sit for that class. Fortunately, I did the class prior to all those prerequisites being in, so I have most of them anyway, but when I took it, those weren't in there.
So yeah, fire instructor, that's the new one. I know I talked to a lot of guys who are like, they never took their fire instructor class. I mean,
correct.
So, I mean, to be an officer, you're going to need that. I understand why, like, because you're supposed to run trainings and stuff like that, and I get it from that perspective, but that's going to be a tough one for everybody to comply with, at least initially.
They're going
to
force it. The good thing is, so I have called Division of Fire and Safety and asked some questions and just said, hey, what's the requirement to run a drill? So you could actually run a company level drill and do training with your guys without having an instructor. Instructors are required for guys that are teaching a state certified program such as Firefighter 1, Fire 2, to teach it in an academy, to do live fire training. But if you're just running a company level drill at your firehouse, you don't necessarily need instructor. It's good to have, as long as somebody knows what they're doing. So when OSHA looks at training, if they come in and say, show me your training records, they're going to look at the person doing the training is adequately experienced and knowledgeable. They leave it very vague. So really you as the fire chief or the leader of the department have to decide, is this person knowledgeable and adequate to teach this training and why? And show that they have background, whether that be 3 years of service, additional training, certifications that they have. So OSHA doesn't look for instructor, but it looks like they're going to be going that route if you're an officer to have that certification.
That's gonna be a tough one. For guys that are in as officers now, because a lot of guys that are in as officers now do not have that, and I know a lot of them don't even have that officer standard yet.
Correct.
The fire officer one. Correct.
Yeah. And they, so there are phase in periods with all this. So when you look at the proposed text, they have phase in periods everywhere from 3 months. So whenever they finally put it into effect, the community risk assessment, for example, has to be done within 3 months. And then it goes all the way up to 24 months on the far end. So whenever they implement it, there's a step approach to when you have to have stuff in. I've been telling everybody, don't wait. Everybody's kind of banking on, is stuff going to go away? Are they going to edit this down? And I can tell you that it's not going to go away. They're taking it very seriously. They have an open public hearing in November, which I'm actually going to be testifying for. Got my 10 minutes to have my piece.
There you go. Where's that going to be?
So they usually do them in Washington, D.C., but because of the impact of this, they're doing it virtually. So you could attend from anywhere in the country.
Because they have a national audience, obviously.
Correct. And there's a lot of people pushing, including National Volunteer Fire Council, is pushing them to just completely abolish this standard and not. And you may have heard me say this elsewhere. Everybody's always saying, well, what's the difference between paid and volunteer? There's no difference. We're all the same. We go through the same training. But now when it comes to these safety standards, everybody's trying to differentiate volunteer from paid. And I'm on the volunteer side, and I'm saying, no, stop. You can't differentiate. Maybe we need a little bit longer time to implement. I could get behind that. Yes, there's some parts of the proposal that need to be edited and need to be kind of subdued a little bit. For example, the clean cab stuff. They're forcing within that text that you cannot have contaminated gear in the truck. So what happens to the departments that have one set of gear per person? What are we doing right after a fire? Do we not have gear? Are we out of service? Those are the kind of questions that I have.
Yeah, we'd be out of service too in our company because nobody has. I mean, we have a couple sets of spare gear that are, gear from guys that have left, and it's still within standards, and we keep it clean, we keep it locked up in the back. I mean, that's the best we're going to do is give out five sets of gear after a structure fire. So what does that leave you, five guys to kind of carry on with everything else?
And also, there's ways for, we're somewhat what I'll call lower volume in terms of fire. But if you look at, for example, like Detroit, we were just talking before. If they're getting 10 fires in a shift, how are they changing out gear that fast and washing gear? It's just not feasible. So there needs to be some level of flexibility with that. Which the current regulation doesn't have. Another big issue within this proposal is, so they're going to incorporate by reference 22 NFPA standards. But at the same time, NFPA is going through this consolidation project for emergency response standards. So they're consolidating, I think it's 111 down to 30 some odd standards. So for example, they're going to take like all the standards for PPE and for turnout gear and pass alarms and SCBAs and put them all into one standard with chapters. So the point of that is less committees because they also don't have a lot of people. And then it's also cheaper for us to purchase a standard because now we're purchasing one that contains what used to be four. So I get why they're doing it. But OSHA's saying they're going to incorporate by reference those consolidation standards. But it's going to be equivalent to 22 of the equivalent standards, if that makes sense. So one of the pushbacks has been, I've seen other people say this as well, and I agree with it. Don't incorporate by reference the full text in an NFPA standard because it's very hard for us to comply with those as volunteers in full. Take the sections out that you want and put them physically into the OSHA text because also NFPA updates their standards every 3 years. OSHA, it takes them 10 years to update one, if they can even get it done that fast. So they're going to be constantly behind. And once they lock in an NFPA standard, now we have to comply with an old version. They could come out with new ones, but until OSHA adopts that,
it doesn't make a difference.
It's not going to keep up.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, federal government, it is the process to get OSHA regulations. It's slow. I mean,
correct.
We're not an OSHA state here in New Jersey, but we are a PIOSH, and basically it's the same thing. We basically just adopt everything in kind as
they're,
as
OSHA they're required to adopt everything identically or more strict. So New Jersey PIOSH has adopted every OSHA standard, with the exception of two that they've implemented a higher level of requirements. One is what they call the firefighter standard, which will be obsolete when this comes out because it'll all be covered in there. And then the second one is the hazard communication standard. They actually make it more strict in New Jersey, where we have to do the training at minimum every 2 years, where other states it's not required.
Yeah, that HAZCOM course that we used to
– correct.
That we still take every 24 months, right?
It's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting, and, you know – you look at the state of volunteerism as it is, and I don't know about the rest of the country, but I know how it is over here in New Jersey, and it's tough to get volunteers, especially, you know, the cost of living is going up. People don't have the time to give away their free time. They're busier, and I mean, I think when I took Fire One, it was, I don't even want to say, it was probably 86 or 88 hours back then. Now it's got to be closer to, what, 200, 300 hours?
Yeah, when I took it in 2009, 2010, it was in like the 150 range, I believe. And then my wife's a firefighter on our department as well. She joined later than me and went, I want to say, about 6 years after I did, maybe even longer. And her class was considerably longer. So just within that 6 to 8 year period.
Well, now, do you have a pro board cert or you have the original?
So my firefighter one was not pro board. Morris County Public Safety Training Academy was not a pro board academy at the time. I took fire two. I was the last Fire 2 class that was not pro board. So then they got pro board IFSAC certified, and I basically sent an email to the director of the academy at the time and said, I really want pro board. Do I have to go take Fire 2 again? Because at the time I was thinking about being a paid fireman. And they said, well, we're doing this trial. We're going to put a couple guys through. The state has approved it, where you got to come and do 3 hands-on nights with the current Fire 2 class and then retake the written exam, and you'll get pro board. So me and one instructor at the time that also was in the same boat as me, we went back, did that. So I took Fire 2 again, technically, and then passed that, and I got my pro board Fire 2 that way.
Yeah, it was like a pro board challenge that they did, like when it first came out. I didn't do it. I by the time people found out about it, it was kind of like the window of opportunity had really passed, and the only thing for me is I have a house in North Carolina. They're a pro board state, but, you know, I'm not looking to
when you're on vacation, do you really want to be working again?
Well, you know, if I move down there and retire down there, do I really want to be, you know, I can find something else to fill my time. I've been doing this for 33 years. I love it, but at some point, you know, I'm a life member at my fire company. I can come up whenever I want, visit. You know, I don't have to ride the fire trucks and, you know, to feel good about myself. You know, I'm good. I've done a lot, and, you know, would it be nice to have pro board? Yeah, it would be nice, but, you know, they should have done something, and as typical with the state, they always, I don't want to say, they don't think it through completely. Like, they should have, like, put it out there, hey, listen, if you have a Fire 1 certificate, Fire 2, like, we're going to do a pro board, like, send it out to everybody. Let everybody know and give everybody the opportunity, but it was kind of like, they never even did that. It was just kind of like, if you knew, you knew, and if you didn't, you didn't, and, you know.
One of the big things, too, coming with the OSHA proposal as far as training is when you get into the technical rescue disciplines. So they're now proposing that any time you're going to offer a technical rescue discipline, you have to train to the technician level. Awareness level minimum for every first responder for every discipline. So every responder needs to have confined space awareness, water rescue awareness, rope awareness, so that when you get to a scene, you understand it's beyond your capability, can call, can kind of control the scene. On top of that, if you're going to offer, like I said, any of the technical rescue disciplines, physically offer those services, the ops level is no longer a thing. You have to go to the tech level. When you look at what that entails, that's a huge financial investment for a lot of departments, a lot of time. A lot of people just aren't going to be able to offer those services. So I think you're going to see a lot more regionalized teams. because not every fire department can do every discipline.
It gets expensive, and manpower issues are very limiting.
The state of New Jersey right now actually does not have a certification program for technical rescue. Like, you applied in New Jersey DFS for your Fire 1, your Fire 2, your incident management levels 1, 2, and 3.
Yep.
They don't have a state certification for any of those disciplines. So it's up to you, or like, as a fire chief, I could hire a company that comes in and teaches to the NFPA standard for rope rescue, let's say. Their certificate just means that we did the training. There's no certification per se. I know DFS has mentioned they're working on it. We'll get there at some point where you'll have to, send in certifications, apply to the state, and you'll be a certified rope rescue technician or whatever they end up calling.
Because I don't think water rescue does that either, right?
No. Right now, it's really what I'll call best practice. You have to make sure that the people that are teaching you know their stuff and that the equipment that you're using is the right stuff. It's really on you.
Which can get scary, because even in the trainings, something could go wrong in a water situation, a confined space situation. If you're training, you got to have
it really depends confidence on who you're hiring too. You have to do your due diligence. Like, I have my company doing safety compliance, and I do certain trainings, but like, I'll never offer water rescue training because I don't know what I'm doing. But if I were to offer water rescue training and somebody say, let's hire him, you got to do your due diligence with them.
Unless you hire somebody who's an expert in it, and that's their their forte, and they do it for you. I understand you don't want to.
So you really got to look into who you're hiring to do those technical rescue type trainings.
I mean, I know in my department we have a swift water team. We do ice water rescue. We don't have a dive team. We don't really have a per se confined space team. I mean, we have a couple guys that have confined space because they're paid guys somewhere else, and they have some more confined space training or technical rescue training. But, a lot of that's county or mutual aid. I mean, even hazmat for us, even though we have a section of 287 here, just up the road, we don't have a hazmat team per se. We have awareness and operational, and we know to stay back, and we call either Mahwah or some of our mutual aid towns that have hazmat. And I'm sure you guys in Mine Hill are the same way.
Yeah, right? We're fortunate when it comes to hazmat because we have Picatinny Arsenal down the street.
Yep.
They're a great fire department. They essentially have to be able to do everything because of their coverage area on that base. There's a lot of buildings and areas that they just can't let mutual aid into, so they have to be able to get in there and do everything. And their hazmat is really their specialty because of what they have on that base and
what they deal with. Yeah.
So when we need hazmat, they come. They got a tractor trailer. They got another tandem axle heavy rescue. They got a trailer decon unit that they pull. They got a whole fleet just for hazmat.
It's great that you have that resource available to you. I mean,
federal money.
Yeah, and it frees you up to not have to invest in it, right? Like as a town or as a department, you guys, smaller departments, small budgets, and a lot of we're in a unique position where we are in New Jersey in that everything's small town, like. You go out Midwest, down South, towns are 3-4 times the size of what we are. There are fire districts down there. It's different than it is here, where everything's a little,
Home rule here. Yeah. And
little
then,
fiefdoms, right?
I mean, there's a couple, I won't say names, but there's 3 or 4 areas in Morris County alone that you can drive down one street and pass 2 firehouses within 3 blocks just because they're technically in 2 different towns.
And years ago, it was not a big deal, but now the price of an engine now is
$1 million for a lot of trucks.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be $250,000 would get you a basic engine. Now it's basically you're looking at $1 million.
Yeah, most trucks are at least $800,000.
And that's as basic as they come. Yeah, and that's not even equipping them.
Yeah, you put anything fancy on it, you're up to $1 million. Some of the ladders are up over $2 million easily.
Yeah, yeah, and that's an issue that is going to rear its ugly head. I mean, we pay high enough taxes right now in New Jersey. If you can offset some of the tax burden by having either some kind of mutual aid agreement or fire districting or something like that, which, I know people, we can't do that because, and I know guys on your fire department, same as mine, where, when you joined, the guy was like, why are we doing it that way? Oh, because that's the way it should be done. Well, we never did it that way. And then you got to go through, why it's better, because it's safer, it's whatever, it's the new standard or whatever it is. But there's always this guy, it's tradition, right? It's tradition. But at some point, things are going to have to change, because I know for us, I can't speak for other towns and other municipalities, but for us, our volunteerism rate is declining. We're losing more volunteers than we're gaining as these guys age out. And, you know, at some point, we're going to have to supplement with either per diems, some kind of mutual aid program, or something along those lines that's, you know, until eventually it's either going to be a local or countywide career department. I mean, it's the way the world is going, and especially with, you know, we're talking about how much training is involved now, and it's just going to keep going and going. And I know there was some talk about possibly some CEUs like the EMTs are doing now. I had heard some talk about that. I don't know.
So that's not part of the OSHA proposal. I'm not sure if the state will go that direction.
I heard it was a push from the state what I had heard.
It may be because a big issue is continuous education. So you get a lot of guys, and I see this in my firehouse, they'll join, they'll take Fire 1 and never take another class again, and that's not beneficial to them or the community or the fellow first responders alongside them that are relying on them to help out.
We're going to have to pull them out when they get in trouble.
Yeah, and then, I mean, back to what you were saying before, I don't know how Bergen works up where you are, but in Morris County, we have a great mutual aid agreement. The county went through, I want to say it's probably close to 10 years at this point, might be more, and they went through and got every town to sign on to a mutual aid agreement. They worked really hard to get it together. So Morris County is all under one mutual aid agreement now. The MAC coordinators obviously coordinate any out-of-county mutual aid. So like you were saying you were in Morris County the other day with the dive team because, you know, all of our dive resources in Morris have been depleted. The only department left is Parsippany Rescue and Recovery. So when there's a dive incident in Morris County, it's all Bergen and Passaic units plus Parsippany.
Yeah, we were a backup for them.
But when you look at the manpower issue, the way I built out my box alarms in Mine Hill, so we're a smaller town surrounded by Roxbury, Randolph, Dover, Wharton, and Picatinny. And so we built the box alarms out where when we hit a second alarm, we're getting one unit from each department around us, and we know that each one's coming with 3 to 4 on it. So we're going to get the crew that we need, but also knowing that everybody's a little short-staffed. Good thing for me is, fortunately, like I said, Picatinny's full paid all the time. When I call them, I get 8 guys, 2 pieces of apparatus for a rig team, or I can call an engine. I call for a ladder. I call for hazmat. They have a tender. They have boats. They have everything. And then Dover, right down the street, the other direction, is paid usually with 3 to 4 on at a time now, too. So I know I'm getting...
I didn't know Dover was paid.
Yeah, I'm getting an engine out of them almost instantly as long as they're not on another call. So I know on my box alarm, even during a day, I got 2 paid crews coming with between the two. It's around 12 people. And then on top of that, I'm calling in Roxbury, Randolph, Wharton. We're getting a handful more guys out of them. So in any given day, we're getting anywhere from 20 to 25 on our second alarm with a handful of apparatus.
That's great because, you know, we don't have much career around us. We have Ridgewood, which is career, which is 3 towns over, so it's a hot minute before we get to them. It's mostly volunteer around us. So, and then the other issue we have is we are not a full county mutual aid. We have 1, 2, 3, or 4 mutual aid associations with the county. We're in the Northwest Bergen Mutual Aid. Then there's the Central Bergen, Eastern Bergen, and Southern Bergen, I think, are the way the mutual aid associations. But we also have 72 municipalities in Bergen County.
Yeah, we have 39 in Morris.
And we have 72, and some are, if you sneeze while you're driving through, you're going to miss the whole town, you know, so they're smaller. And some of them still get, you know, they still have a lot of blue collar, so they get more volunteers. It seems like the blue collar workers are more apt to volunteer their time, probably because they have more time, you know, because I know our biggest issue was we have a lot of people moving in our town that, you know, they commute to New York City, and that extra 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours at night, you know, takes an 8-hour day, and, you know, it really adds to makes it a 12-hour day. And then, you know, who's coming home to say, hey, listen, I can't wait to go to the fire academy tonight.
Well, and on top of that, we're seeing, and I'm sure it's out by you too, all the development is not single-family homes. It's these big buildings with 40 units in the building, complexes with 300-400 units, and the people are all moving out of the city. And, you know, FDNY is there, paid volunteer fire department is not a thing. They don't even understand it. When they come out, they're buying these places because they don't want to do lawn maintenance. They don't want to maintain a property. They want to work during the week, come home, and then go and enjoy the weekend. They're not coming to volunteer. They don't want to put the time in.
And we had a conversation before we even started. And, you know, the other issue we have is we have the same thing. People come to New York, and they assume, like, when we get there, they're like, oh, what took you so long? Oh, we're not paid. We're volunteers. And they have the concept, like you said, you know, they're coming out of a city where they're used to having paid services, and they have no concept of that. They didn't even think about that when they moved out of town or out of the city to the town.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how things go in a couple years. I mean, with all this consolidation and, you know, what are we talking, 24 to 36 months before you start seeing all the changes to the OSHA regulations, the NFPA, and then trickling down to the states, I would say, you know, like you said, some stuff's going to be almost immediate, but other stuff's going to take time.
Yep.
And, you know, I know there's certain things that they want, certain changes they want to make, you know, for the better, but which is great, but they just can't shove it down your throat because it takes time to get guys trained. And, you know, there's a lot of issues, especially on the volunteer side.
Well,
not
I see
that it's an excuse, but
it's not even just a matter of time. It's a matter of knowledge. So, you know, one of the things I tell everybody during my training is the first thing you need to do is figure out what resource within your fire department, which person is going to be responsible for health and safety and being the health and safety officer to manage these programs, because everything requires annual reviews and training and somebody just to manage all that. And if you don't have that person in your firehouse, whether they're nobody's willing or they just don't have the knowledge, you either need to outsource it or get somebody to kind of coach that person along, which is what I do. There's not a lot of people like me that do it. I'm sure a couple more will surface as this comes about.
Yeah.
But again, that, you know, that's a budget issue for fire departments. They don't have a safety budget to be able to hire somebody to help out. A lot of the document stuff I get, the risk management plan and sitting down and actually setting up programs and SOPs, I'm on board with all that. One of the biggest things that bothers me about this new proposal is what they call control zones. So they're saying on every incident they want a no entry. Well, if you need a no entry zone, let's say you have a down power line or you have a collapse hazard. That I get. We already do that. But they also want hot, warm, and cold zones. Certain resources can be in certain places. And the implementation of those zones is not the issue. It's how they want it done. So they want physical barriers, whether that be with tape or with cones. Now think about a commercial building that's 100 by 100 on the small side. How are you putting all those? You're going to need miles of tape. You're going to need multiple people just to put the tape out. It's just not feasible to do that. So I think they really need to enforce the barricading of the no entry zone and then delineation of those zones with somebody to control it, but not physical marking of those zones. It's just possible.
How many cones or yeah. barricade, you know, the horse barricades can you carry?
I mean, need the DOT to roll behind the engine.
Yeah, you need a tractor trailer. Yeah.
With all the cones on the back. Yeah. They could drive around and drop them off the back of the truck.
Yeah, you know, and you're right, especially, you know, structure fires, single family house, not a huge problem. Go to a shopping center, big industrial building. I mean, I know we have Becton Dickinson in our town. They have two buildings. I mean, it would probably take a couple hours just to set up the zones outside while guys are working. It's a huge undertaking, and you know, I had heard you speak about that before as well, and I you know, it is an issue. I mean, hopefully they can figure that out. I mean, if they get a no entry zone past a certain point, or you know, authorized personnel type only, like, you know, you got to be certified interior firefighter to come past this point, and then you have your zones inside. I can understand that. I mean, but, you know, just to try and set it up, you know, they had it the other night only because of where we were, you know, they were investigating something. So, you know, they set it up. So they had, you know, one way in, one way out, and everybody had to check in and check out. I mean, but it was a small incident. It was very.
Yeah, but you know, when you think about a fire, people are going to be getting there trying to do stuff quick. They're not going to slow down and do all those zones first. I think what OSHA is really looking for, and I agree with it, and I'll speak from Morris County, we're really bad at staging and controlling resources and accountability. We need to get better at that, and that's ultimately the goal, is they want to see the control of resources, elimination of freelancing, and to ensure that everybody's supervised and that span of control is there. If we can do that, I don't think any OSHA inspector is ever going to cite a fire department for not physically taping something out, as long as the controls are there and the ultimate goal is obtained.
Well, and I think having mutually coordinators is a big step towards that, because then you can assign somebody from the coordinators, hey, listen, set up staging, and I'll let you know what we need. Because, I mean, how many times when you're a chief, you're at a fire, you got mutual aid rolling in. You know, I remember when I was chief, you got guys hopping off a ladder truck, and, hey, listen, I need you guys to ladder the building. Okay, no problem. And then the next thing you see is guys with hooks start taking the whole front. Well, we don't want to do that yet. But there's nobody, there's a lot of freelancing, and there's, like you said, you lose control. And I think having a staging area and getting everybody in a staging first, but you know how fire is, especially we don't see a lot of fire in my town. I'm sure you guys are in the same boat. So guys are gung-ho when it happens, and then, mutually everybody's trying to get their time in to work. And so everybody's kind of crashing the party or crashing the front door as quick as they can and that's, again, that's where you lose the scene, really, right? I mean, that's kind of where it kind of goes downhill.
Well, that's not, when I'm talking to the officers coming up underneath me, I try to explain to them that once you lose that control, you're not getting it back. You have to start off the right way, because you can't dial the guys back. You can't call them back. You can't get them back into staging. It just doesn't ever happen. So we've tried to, as we have resources coming in, stage them away from the incident, have them come up to command, get an assignment, put them to work. I have seen improvement, not just in our town, other towns around us. We did implement, so Morris County did a county accountability system where we came out with truck tags. So they hang in the tag in the truck, and they've got multiple spots for each seat with the name driver, officer, seat one, seat two. And we clip our accountability tags to those. So then that whole truck tag goes to command. We're not trying to collect individual tags. You can say Mine Hill Engine 2 has 5 guys on it. Here's the whole package. So everybody in the county bought those tags, or most people did.
That's a good. We have tags in our apparatus, but it's basically it's a tag ring with the town and apparatus number on it. But we don't bring it anywhere. We hang it in there. God forbid something doesn't happen, we're not going back to look to see who's missing what at the end. I mean, we carry 2 tags, one for the apparatus, one for
when you're going inside.
When we're going inside. Yeah. I mean, but sometimes you get to the front door of a house and there's
nobody there.
There's nobody there, or you throw it on the ground, and then you get back from a mutual aid fire and you're like, oh.
They have a thing now for that. It's a ring that goes on top of a cone. So you could drop the traffic cone at the front door.
With the ring on
it. And it has a ring on the top, so you just clip on. But it takes the discipline of
actually
grab the cone and put it at the door.
And, actually getting people to adhere to it. And, I know years ago there used to be a safety officer. We used to have an older guy that used to do it. He wasn't an interior firefighter. He'd sit there, almost look, we had one that was like a spike type thing and had a couple rings on it. And he would try and yell at people as they came through, and a lot of guys were like, hey, hang on. And, they would be reaching for it, and then next thing you know, they're running through the door because they see fire, or they get excited about stuff. So, sometimes we are our own worst enemy, though. So, I mean, it's understandable. But, I agree with you. Once you lose that control at a scene, when you get it back? When you get back to the firehouse.
Exactly.
It never comes back on the scene. I mean, it is tough. And I think – our chief now, he does a pretty good job, because you wouldn't know if we had a structure fire or if we were going to a CO alarm. Everything's the same, and it's just the way he's been. He's been doing this a long time. He's been chief a couple times with us, and he's almost just like a calm, cool, like you would never know. And guys, some of the mutual aid towns are like, man, I can't believe how you get there. And because they come in on mutual aid and they're like, man, the chief sounded like it was just nothing. But part of it is trying to, as a chief officer or even the officer on the engine, you don't want to be – you try not to get amped up, because what happens when you get amped up? Then the next guy – it just –
I try to do the same thing. I won't say I'm perfect at it, but so Morris County went to – for the dispatching, it's automated now, so you don't get the excitement in the dispatcher's voice as well. So it all comes across pretty even. There are studies out there that if, the chief or the first person on scene is yelling on the radio or amped up, that the guys coming in are the same, and – it really sets the tone for the incident.
Yeah, and we hear it too. Like, our chief will, we'll hear the cops call on scene, and they're screaming, "I'll get the fire department out here." That there's people, whatever. There's people on the second, whatever it is, right? And our chief will get there. I'm seeing, I got a structure fire. Start me my second alarm assignment. Start backfilling my houses. And but the tone's already set, because the guys have heard the cops, and the cops are a little panicked, because they may have somebody outside or on a balcony or somebody unaccounted for. And it's, it's understandable. It's human nature, but
I've always had this idea, and I don't know that it would take off well. So these classes I've been putting together for my business. I would love to do a class where it's just aimed at how to operate on a fire scene for police, where they come to this class and we talk about everything from size up to radio communications to positioning the patrol vehicle to how to handle a CO incident, because they're really a first resource on scene. And lucky for me in my town, we're a shared police department with Wharton. Wharton Mine Hill is one police department. We contract them because we used to have our own, and we're just too small to maintain that. So it's more cost effective. A lot of the Wharton Wharton police officers are past firemen, either from Wharton or from surrounding towns. So we actually get along really well with our cops, and they're really helpful.
And they get it.
Yeah, most of them really get it. But I think it'd be great to be able to put a class out there that, hey, come sit here for 2 hours, and we'll talk about how to help the fire department before they're there. Because, you know, if your cars are all blocking the street, you know, a lot of the times I'll get there and there's a structure fire and they get out and they're trying to help people first. I'm like, hey, so the engine's like 1 minute down the street. I need these cars out of here or you're going to get blocked and you're going to be here for the next 3 days. Like, you need to move.
Yeah. And that's commonplace. You know, we have a couple officers that are very cognizant of it. They try and get at least a house and a half away if they can. You know, obviously, you know, a lot of times you got somebody standing there, you know, they're going to park where they got to stop because somebody's panicked outside the house or whatever it is. But I understand that completely, and we, you know, I've heard, you know, we're on the engine driving to a call, and it's a CO alarm, and it's a newer cop, and he gets on the radio, and goes, I'm out investigating. I don't smell or see anything. You can tell the fire department slow to response.
So we've had a couple times, and I won't use names. The officers are no longer there, so it's not representative of the current force. But they would get on scene, oh, you can cancel the fire department. And our policy is once we're called, we're responding.
Ours is too, because we...
Nobody's canceling us. We need to go make sure. So if we get on scene, it's really nothing. We could easily just drive away. One specific incident, the officer called in and said, you can cancel. I said, no, we're going to continue in for a CO alarm. The guy has a garage in the basement from the back of his house because the house is on a hill. And he was running his ride-on lawnmower in the garage, and the house had 150 ppm of CO in it that he was trying to cancel us for. And that's happened multiple times.
Yeah, so we've had that issue before. I mean, it's, you know, and you don't think people can be doing silly things like that. And, you know, you're like, oh, you know, I mean, how many times have you ever heard, you see the warning on a generator, right? Don't run it inside the house. Don't run it inside the house. And I'm like, who's going to run there? And then we'll go to that call where the CO alarm's going off and you're like, why'd you put the generator right outside the garage door with the exhaust pointing in? And they're like, oh, well, that's because that's the way I can get my electrical outlet to plug in the easiest. I'm like, you know, you know, so, yeah. But
I just think if we did a class like that and educated them, because, I mean, there's things, you know, you don't want to pull up and find the officer dead in the house.
No, it's
and
true.
Hydrogen sulfide, for example. I always tell everybody that doesn't know about it. It quickly makes you nose blind, depending on what level it's at, because when you'll get a first smell, and then at a certain level, it's around 500 ppm. You actually can't smell it anymore, so you think it went away. But over that level is when it starts to get deadly. So if an officer to walk in doesn't have that training, gets a hit of it, and says, oh, it went away, and starts walking to the house, you could easily find them dead in the house. So, you know, maybe it's even something that they need to add into the training program for new recruits.
Yeah, a couple hours at the police academy just to go over that
would be
sufficient. I mean, but yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and EMS is the same way too. You know, we used to do, years ago when I first joined, we'd do drilling with our EMS guys. We did a lot more drilling. We would do, you know, extrication practices with them, get them, like, so they could get in a car with a patient while we're cutting around them, so they could kind of, you know, now we have issues in our town with, you know, just getting enough EMTs to respond to calls. They don't seem to drill as much as they used to. And you know, even the fire service, we don't have as many guys coming out to drill as we used to. I mean, you know, We have those guys that always make you nervous because you'll see them at the structure fire, and then the next time you see them, it's the next structure fire, which could be a month, could be 8 months, it could be almost a year, and you're like, oh, you know, haven't seen this guy. And
well, it's part of this new OSHA standard, and it's actually there now. People just don't know about it. You have to, at minimum, if you're an interior firefighter, do 4 drills per year using an SCBA. And they have to be quarterly. So you can't cram them all into 1 month and say, I did 4. You have to actually show up once per quarter and do a drill utilizing an SCBA, something to do with fire suppression. So the state of New Jersey, PIOSH, requires that now. but that's also going to become part of the new OSHA expectation. So those guys actually aren't in compliance. I've had to have a conversation with a few people that, hey, listen, when you show up, you have to be clean shaven. When you show up, if you haven't been to training in 6 months, you're not an interior firefighter right now. You're not compliant. I'm not taking the risk. When they come in, they send us this huge fine because something happens to you. They come do an investigation, and then all of a sudden the mayor wants to know why I didn't keep up with something. So,
yeah, and we have, you know, listen, we tell guys the same thing. It's like, hey, listen, you know, I'm sometimes I'm the bad guy in the engine. I'm like, hey, listen, you got too much facial hair, but, you know, hey, I need a hydrant guy today. Grab that hydrant. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, there are guys that you know, they don't shave for a week or two, and it's like, you know, and I know that's a big – I know guys that have departments that have gotten fined because they saw, you know, pictures were seen on the internet of a guy in turnout gear with an air pack on. He didn't have a mask on, and he was standing outside. But
not only that, I had a department that told me they were sitting in the middle of an OSHA inspection. They're sitting there with the inspector. Guy walks in the firehouse, and the OSHA inspector said, "Oh, nice to meet you. You a fireman here? Yeah. Do you use an SCBA ever? You go inside? Yeah, of course, all the time. Guy's got a beard. Violation immediately. Wrote him right there.
Yeah, I mean. You know, they don't play games with certain things, so we're pretty good with that. I mean, you know, we're lucky in our town. We get an annual physical. They have a company come in and provide us an annual physical. We do as part of the respiratory, we do a mass fit. So, you know, I know departments that aren't even that far. You know,
and
you're lucky to get
that's a base requirement.
And you're lucky. Some of them, you're lucky to get a physical every year.
Yeah, so we don't do a physical every year. That's so this new OSHA standard is going to make a minimum of every 2 years. So I don't know if you saw, they're going to make you do exposure tracking. So every time you're exposed to byproducts of combustion, has to be recorded. And then once you hit a threshold of 15 times per year, your medical exam has to be equivalent to the requirements under NFPA 1582, which is that extensive exam. I don't know how extensive your annual is, but that has to be done at least every 2 years. So a lot of departments have to increase their medical exams, their frequency, but then every year you have to have that fit test. And when I say every year, it has to be within 12 months. So you can't do it like January this year and December next year because that's actually 24 months apart. It has to be within 12 months.
Okay. Yeah, we do ours every February. We do our physicals are scheduled the same, and then we try and do our...
Yeah, we do them in the cold months. It's good, you know. Yeah. You don't want to have an outdoor drill one night. You do that one night.
Yeah, we have a company come in and do our physicals. I mean, we're not to the standard of, like, they don't make you, you know, put on an air pack and run up two flights of stairs and come back down. And I mean,
yeah, that's not going to be a requirement. The 1582 is more, you know, there's a chest X-ray and actually an audiogram to start monitoring for hearing loss. So there's some benefit to it too. Where you know, and I talked to when I did the one for fire engineering, the guy I was talking to, he has occupational hearing loss. The doctor fully said it's occupational related, but his workers' comp claim was denied because he didn't have documentation of all the exposures. So those exposure documents, every time you go to a car fire, a house fire, a CO incident, you fill out that exposure control document documenting what you were exposed to and when, and that goes in your medical file. You get cancer 20 years down the road, you could pull out 50 different exposures and hand those to your workers' comp attorney. The insurance company can't deny your claim.
Yeah.
They can try, but...
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely... It's an easier case to build than...
Yeah.
You don't have any documentation. It's like it never happened, right? That's what they tell you.
There's a lot of good things there in this proposal such as that will serve us in the long run. It's just a matter of implementing them.
So 15 exposures, though. I mean, again, take the Detroit example. That could be
a day.
Two shifts.
Yeah, so and then when they say exposures, they made clear that's without regard for use of respiratory protection. So even if you're using respiratory protection, it's still considered an exposure because you can absorb through your skin, through your gear. Cooking fires. So you pull up to a burnt pot on the stove, you're now exposed to byproducts of combustion. A lot of times those are actually more hazardous than the other fires because the burning Teflon and the stuff that's actually burning in the pan. So that's all going to be considered an exposure. I think most departments will easily hit that 15. And there's a lot of question in the final proposal whether they're going to stick with the number 15, make it lower, make it higher. I think they should make it a little bit higher. But at the end of the day, if you're exposed 15 times or 20, really you're at the same risk. The right thing to do is to still have those exams and to do that exposure tracking. To make it easy in Mine Hill, I made one form for exposure reporting. So whether you're exposed to byproducts of combustion, carbon monoxide, a chemical, bloodborne pathogens, anything, it's the same form. There's a lot of options on there, so we don't have to have all these different forms. It's all linked to our exposure control plan. You fill out the form, sign it, drop it in the chief's box, gets put in your medical file.
That's great. That's great. I mean, we haven't gotten that far yet, but I mean, the perfect example is the cooking. I mean, how many times you walk in, you're not masked up for that, right? You walk in because it's cooking on the stove. So you walk in and you're like, oh yeah, they, you know, we had a couple where we had to force entry because you go around the back, you can see in the kitchen the smoke coming out, and you know they left a pot of boiling water. It's usually eggs. They usually smell rancid when you get in there because it's eggs that have burned out, you know, that have boiled off.
Eggs or oil?
Yeah.
The oil lights off.
Yeah, and you know, it's, you never have your mask on because it's cooking, right? I mean, so I get it. I mean, there's a lot of, as much as there's some things that are going to be roadblocks or speed humps to slow things down, you know, cause some issues, I think overall it's going to benefit all the firefighters, right? I mean, that's, you know, as far as a safety and documentation standpoint.
Well, and driving too. So they're actually expecting you now to follow. It's going to be a combination standard, but NFPA 1002 or 3 it is right now. I don't remember which one is for apparatus operators. You have to train your operators to those standards. So there's like a checklist that they need to go through of how many left-hand turns, how many right, how many pumping, and to make sure they're really qualified. You need to document that. And one of the last classes I was doing, I was going over that. When I talked about OSHA's expectation for an SOP for emergency vehicle operations, they have specifics they're expecting in this SOP. And one of them was stopping at railroad crossings. And I thought the room was going to blow up when I said that. Everybody was up in arms. What do you mean we have to stop at a railroad crossing? We're an emergency vehicle. And I was surprised that, I mean, now I understand why they're putting that out there in writing. Not everybody is doing that, which to me, I think that's pretty much common sense. But
what, stopping at a railroad?
Yeah.
Like a bus every time or just when the gates are down?
No, every time.
Every time?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have railroad tracks through our town. I mean, you have to slow down so much to get through ours that you would see them, but
yeah,
we did have a structure fire as we were coming up to the train tracks and the lights started to go off and it was a train going through. We had to just wait it took 2 minutes. I mean, what are you gonna do? By the time you go back around, you might as well just wait the train out. But it's
exactly,
you know, it was weird because I was in the office. I called command. I'm like, just be advised, we're stuck by a train. He's like, oh, you could hear in his voice. He was like, oh man, what else could go wrong tonight? But it happens, right?
Yeah. And,
you know, yeah, I mean, safety. And I mean, that's why we stopped riding the rear step. You know, you talk to the guys from the 70s. Oh, we never wore masks. You know, they fought car fires with no masks on. They were interior firefighters with no masks on years ago. I mean, you know, that was the thing, right? And
the hazards have changed a little bit, though. Like, you got a lot of different, you know, materials now. This table's not wood, you know, it's now made of plastic and it looks like wood.
Oh yeah, this stuff looks going to give off some nasty fumes, and it's understandable. But you know, you talk to the old school guys, and they're like, "Oh, I remember when we used to ride the rear step and this and that." They eliminated all that because of safety, because people died, people got injured, you know. So everything's, you know, and like you said earlier, I get the whole volunteer versus paid, but we're all still professionals under one. Yeah, umbrella.
We need to get to the same point and be under the same regulations. It's just a matter of the timing to get there and the resources. Yeah. So one of the biggest things that I've heard pushback on is, well, this is an unfunded mandate. Where's the funding? And I agree the federal government should come out with some funding for this where, you know, based on the volume of your calls, you're eligible for X amount of money to put toward developing your safety program. Now, obviously, they can't do that forever. You need to be able to manage it. But maybe for the first 2 years, if they figure it's going to cost $15,000 in consulting fees for an average-sized department, give them 15 or give them 10, give them something.
Yeah, because you got to give them something, and you know the federal government could hire their own consultants, but as everything else, that'll just it's just too many layers involved. You're better off just giving them money, letting them go out and hire whoever they want to hire to do their consulting work for them and let them do it.
OSHA has that consulting program where you can call them in to audit your site and give you some help and make recommendations. You have to implement them. Whatever they identify as a hazard, you have to fix. But OSHA is a federal agency that's underfunded and understaffed also. They don't have the time to come out to every fire department in the country. New Jersey alone, Morris County, I think there's like, so it's 39 municipalities, but there's so many firehouses within those municipalities.
Yeah.
They just don't have the staffing to do that. So I think if everybody put in a request, they'd be immediately overwhelmed.
Yeah, and that's what would happen, because if you said, oh, you can all apply for this through OSHA and they'll send out somebody to help you, what's the first thing volunteer departments are going to do?
They're going to apply for
it.
They're
going to hop on it because it's free and they can get help out of it, right? Because you're always looking for the assistance. But, yeah, I mean, you know, in the end, at the end of the day, the fire doesn't care if you're paid or volunteer.
Exactly.
And the homeowner who's on their front lawn at 3 o'clock in the morning watching all their personal belongings burn up inside a house, they don't care either. They just want professional people to put the fire out. And, you know, so it's understandable that maybe it'll take a marathon for the volunteers and a half marathon for the career guys to get there. But, you know, it's got to be something.
No, I had the same assumption too. And I did a class not too long ago in Denville. It was open to a lot of different departments, and a couple paid departments sent representatives. And one of them, again, I don't want to use names, but they were from a pretty big city. And they were saying, oh, well, we're already doing these couple things, but not these. So we know where we need to focus our effort. And so, you know, you guys are big. You got a lot of firemen, a big area. You got to have a safety officer for the department. No, we don't.
It's crazy.
So even some of the paid departments really need to consider implementing a new position.
They're always pulling back on budgets, especially, you know, hiring people, because it's not just the salary. It's the benefits, the pensions, and everything else that goes with the salary that everybody complains about, you know.
Well, a lot of the bigger departments, like down in Virginia, they're really good with having a safety officer, and they're usually at the battalion chief level, and they have one per shift. So, you know, if you got four shifts, you got to have four battalion chief positions, which could easily, with benefits, $200,000 a year apiece. That's an $800,000 investment.
Yeah, you're just under $1 million.
Yeah. And that's just for the salary and the benefits.
And then if you got to put them in a car.
Yep.
You know, if they're not riding on the apparatus, and most of those battalion guys they're in their own vehicle.
Yep.
So it's a safety vehicle. So you have to have at least one per shift, right? You have to have one vehicle there that they can leave behind for the shift.
I've had a couple departments that are volunteer call me and say, you know, we want to hire you to do some consulting for us and help us build the program. And their question was, how much for you to do everything for us? And I said, I can't do everything for you. I can guide you through the process. You need to take some ownership. And then when I'm gone, you have to know how to run this. You have to do your annual reviews. You have to, you know, I'm not going to come to every one of your calls and make sure you're doing everything the right way. So there needs to be ownership within each firehouse.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's good to have somebody who's studied and knows the ins and outs, but it's great that you know it. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, when, you know, we're at a house fire, we got to know it too, because you're not there to sit on somebody's shoulder and go, okay, now you got to do this, now you got to do that. I mean, but yeah, you're right. I mean, I understand the whole concept of taking ownership, and it's going to be interesting to see where this all ends up in the next couple of years. I mean, is it going to create more per diem and career jobs? It may.
A lot of people are saying that a lot of volunteer firehouses will shut down, that they won't be able to operate, and I don't think that's the case. You know, OSHA, again, is understaffed. They're not going to, on day one, walk into every firehouse, say, give me these 10 things or we're closing your doors and fining you. That's just not going to happen. Obviously, we need to work toward compliance, but if on day one you're 50% there, just keep working toward it. It doesn't mean you need to close your doors.
You might be 50% closer than another department, too. So
yeah.
Yeah, no, and I don't think it's going to be like that. I think, but, you know, you are going to lose guys in the physicals as they get older.
That just don't want to do it.
Don't want to do it. I mean, guys are going to age out. I mean, you know, at what point do you want to be an interior firefighter? You know, we have a couple guys in our department that are almost 70. They're still doing interior firefighting. They still take their physical. They pass it. But, you know, if the physical gets a little bit more in depth, you know, maybe they don't pass it. Maybe they don't want to take it. I mean, you know, so, you know, they'll those will be the issues we'll have. And then we'll either have to, you know, create our own fire districts or maybe supplement with a little bit of, you know, paid personnel during the day or whatever it might be to, you know, supplement, but keep the volunteerism going. I mean, but you know, you just don't see the level of volunteerism that you used to see. I mean,
they, well, and even the volunteers you have aren't necessarily working in town and able to leave at work during the day. I know years ago, a lot of DPW workers used to be on the fire department because they were in town. Our DPW is like 5 guys, and none of them are on the fire department anymore. So we got a couple guys that work for themselves that are in town as contractors most days. I got 2 that are like retired and are drivers and pumpers during the day. So, you know, we get through based off of those guys.
Yeah, and you know who's around, who you can kind of rely on. Like you said, you got the retirees. At least you got some drivers. You know, they can get you there. But it's great having a retired guy who's driving. But you need manpower in the engine with him, right? I mean,
yep.
So, but you know, and there's some creative ways. I mean, we still have a couple DPW guys on our department. You know, some kind of towns have gone to, you know, 1 or 2 man full time fire prevention to do the inspections, and that
they're,
you know,
available.
You have them available to supplement, yeah, if there's something. So, I mean, you know, there's options out there to make it work.
That's big in Mount Olive by us. They've got a few guys for the fire marshal. I know Roxbury's got one during a day. Randolph's got 2 or 3. So that's a big help to them.
Yeah, I mean, we have mostly part-time guys by us. I think we have 4 part-time guys. So it's a little different for us. There's not always, but you know, if it push comes to shove, maybe they put on 2 full-time guys instead of 4 part-timers, and you know, then you can at least got 2 guys around during the day that can respond to calls and things like that. I mean, you know, there are ways to make it work without going paid, but you got to have a bit of flexibility, especially, like you said, years ago. I mean, I remember when I joined the fire department, I mean, 75% of the guys that we dealt with, you know, that were in the firehouse were there for all the calls. They all either worked in town, they worked for the town, they were all, you know, they were all local guys, you know. Now it's, you know, guy goes into the city or guy, you know, drives 25 minutes to work. He's not coming back for a fire call. He can't.
I remember when I was 19 and 20, I worked at a factory that was in Randolph, so it was right down the street. And I had a good employer that was like, yeah, you could leave for every call. And I literally had 100% for 2 years in a row, didn't miss 1 call. But now I work, you know, much farther away, and that's just not a possibility anymore.
No, and family life makes it harder too. You know, if you got, you know, other responsibilities, you know, it's always family first, right? I mean, even though, exactly, the firehouse is a family too, your primary family comes first, and you know, making sure that
my wife and I, like I said, are both on the department, so we have a 3-year-old. You know, my mother takes him on Saturdays to have, you know, time with the grandson, so Saturdays we're both available. But during the week when we're home, unless one of the neighbors can watch him, we pretty much have to alternate or decide who's going. And, you know, depending on the instance, like when I'm chief, I'm a little more obligated to be there more often.
Yeah, and so you kind of trump her, hey, listen, I got to go to this call. But, and
yeah, she's been really good and supportive of, you know, me being chief. And her brother's down the street. He's my assistant chief right now. But, we, you know, we have a couple neighbors that help out. And
well, it's nice that you have good neighbors like that, too, yeah, and who, you know, really, they understand the volunteerism, right? So they're pitching in doing, you know, they're not volunteering to join the fire department, but they're helping you out in another way by...
Well, that's the thing is, you know, we're volunteers, but every drill night, every week or every meeting night, we're both there. I got to pay for babysitting. So that's what a lot of people don't realize. So now you're paying to volunteer. There's no reimbursement for that. And that's what turns a lot of people off too.
Yeah, no, I know. It's tough. I mean, you know, just driving to the firehouse, you know, some guys drive to the firehouse every month is tank out half a gas. You know, it's money out of your pocket that, yep, you're not going to see back. I mean, you know, it's not easy, and you know, we'll see where it goes from here, but you know, it's always a challenge to try and find people to volunteer, and especially in today's world where, you know, people are trying to do more with money and, you know, trying to work, you know, a lot of guys work second jobs and take on other work, and it's like, you know, where's the fire department fall in, you know, unless you're going to somehow get a nice stipend program that they're going to get enough that they can say, hey, listen, this is my part-time job.
Yeah, you know, we don't do paper call. We don't have low SAP in my town. We get a uniform allowance at the end of the year, and it's based off your percentage. Really, on the high end, if you have over 80%, which for us is about 80 calls a year, you're around $500, which when you think about it is not much.
What are you getting? 2.5 cents an hour by the time you break, yeah, it down to your,
exactly,
you know, and it. Probably no chiefs. You get an extra stipend as an officer or anything like that.
So our chief stipend is $1,500 a year. But because we're over that threshold of, I think it's 600 for the IRS, you pay tax on that.
Of course you do.
Yeah, again, at the end, you know, it's like $375 a quarter minus tax. It's, I don't even feel it.
It's minimal.
Yeah.
It's minimal. It's a dinner. It's taking the family out to dinner, really, once a month. Yeah. Once a quarter, right? That's
exactly.
You know, that's, it's tough. I mean, you know, and then you hear other towns like, the chief's getting $10,000 to be a volunteer fire chief. And I'm like, wow, that's great money.
I know one town that they pay him a few $1,000s a piece. And then on top of that, they also give him a few $1,000s to outfit their vehicle. I know another town that they send their chief at the end of the year on a vacation anywhere they want, their whole family.
That's great. Yeah. Listen, sometimes you got to be creative to make it work. I mean, it's still cheaper than paying for paid services.
Tax abatement's a big one now. So I'm trying to get my town to do it, but I don't think it'll ever happen where there's some towns that based on how many years of service you have and your percentage, they'll actually abate part of your property tax bill. I mean,
yeah, up to a certain amount, right?
Yeah,
I've seen that.
That's a great way to incentivize homeowners in town to want to join the fire department.
So the biggest issue we have in our town is we have a lot of people that live in surrounding towns.
Yeah, so that's hard.
It's hard for us. Like, so I used to live in Franklin Lakes. I just moved back to my old house in Oakland. So maybe it would incentivize me to go down to Oakland and volunteer my time there. You know.
Yeah, but it's not doing anything for you in Franklin Lakes.
No, it's not doing anything for me in Franklin Lakes. And listen, at this point, it is what it is. I'm not there for the money. I'm not there for the tax abatement. I mean, you know, is it nice? Yeah, it would be nice to have to get a little breathing room on something. But you know, I'm still going to volunteer regardless, and I'm still going to come out when I can. You know, and you know, I've been doing it long enough that it's just kind of part of my routine. And you know, my wife's been great with it. She's she's like, I get it. You know, because you know, it's not just me, as you know, it's the whole family, you know, what gets affected. You know, I've missed baseball games for house fires, and I've missed house fires because of baseball games. So it just depends on, you know, where you are at the time and what's going on. But, you know, my kids are definitely at the other end of the spectrum of yours. You have a younger child. Mine are 21 and going to be 18. So, but still, you know, there's still a lot of missed time in there along the way. And I don't think anybody takes that into consideration until you get older and you're like, oh, man, I can't believe I missed, you know, this much of, you know, dinners, family. I mean, how many family parties or, you know, you're at a birthday party and you leave your wife and kid there because.
Because there's a fire or a call.
Because there's a fire call. You know, listen, you may not be running out for the fire alarm or the unburnt cooking, but the possible structure fire, it's in your nature. You're going to go. You know, and it happens. I mean, and you just miss things, and your family just kind of accepts it, right? Because they've been doing it for so long. But and that's another thing. You try and get a guy who's in his mid-30s, hey, why don't you join the fire department? It's got to be buy-in, not just from him. It's got to be from his whole family. Because if he's got a family, if she's got a family. You know, either one. You know, or like you said, if they're both going to join, it's all compromises they have to make and figure out, you know, how they're going to make it work. So it's going to be, like I said, it's going to be interesting. So, but I really appreciate you coming in today. You did give us some great information.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, you do consulting work. So, you know, if you need to reach out to Brian, if you guys need some consulting work done, even private sector or public sector, I'm sure he can, if he can't help you, he'll point you in the right direction. And,
absolutely.
Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching.